obstacles to correct the immediate mistakes. We look down on them. They're inconsiderable. What is the use of not being selfish when with a little effort you can make a neutron bomb? This is the difference of perspective. It is the fact the individual wants anything that takes the mind away from his own need to grow. He wants to be amused. If he has wealth, he spends it recklessly. If he has poverty, he gets what he can by any means possible. But with all of that, the mind, instead of being the leader of a marvelous organization of faculties, is simply catering. And actually, strange as it may seem, the mind isn't particularly pleased over all this. The mind isn't happy and jolly as the result of all kinds of bad decisions that it inspires. It is worried to death. The mind is just as unhappy as the person who has it in his head at that time. The mind is not a self-solving problem. It is one that adding constantly to the creating of them. And the only thing that the mind can do is to suggest partial remedies for mighty mistakes. And the remedies, yet generally, are simply a rearrangement of the elements of the mistakes so that we are still in the same trouble we were in before. So to get the mind out of this squirrel cage in which it functions, we have to go to work on it. So, first of all, we relax. Now, relax doesn't mean do nothing. But relax means that we stop breeding or feeding wrong information into the mind. We stop telling the mind that we want to be rich if it calls for a murder. We got to tell the mind that we want what we want when we want it, and that this is wrong. Little by little, by reducing the temptations which we impose upon the mind, we can prevent a great many of the mistakes that arise from poor mentation. If we are willing to cut down the false appetites, then there will be less bad luck, so-called, hovering around us all the time. Out of a quiet mind, we can then say to the mind, think. And think with the aid of all the instruments that have been given to the mind to help it to think. And the individual whose mind is being considered must help the mind to do this. It must do it by presenting the mind a picture of the world thought. It must remind the mind of the tragedies of selfishness, as represented all over the earth all the time. It must teach the mind the miseries of competition. It must also lose, or help the mind to lose, the idea that the more it has, the happier it'll be. When in reality, as Buddha pointed out, the more we have, the more sleep we lose trying to take care of it. All kinds of things, by a very gentle thought, can be caused to relax. And when we look back on a feud in the family, we can very quietly say to ourselves, let's review this feud. First of all, what good did it accomplish? And someone will say, well, it accomplished some good. I got a great deal of joy out of hating my neighbors. And I'm very happy to say I haven't spoken to my aunt for 25 years. Now, this is an achievement. And of course, it has devastated the aunt, who probably doesn't care and doesn't even know about it. Now, this is the way, if you start analyzing these things and breaking them down, you gradually come to realize that all of the negative, unhealthy attitudes that we have are bad bargains at best. So we didn't talk to the aunt for 25 years. In our heart, there was a wrangle. There was a hatred. There was a disturbance. And in the body, that means there's an acidosis. You cannot hate somebody without the body suffering, regardless of how you do it. You cannot ignore a virtue without giving grounds to a vice. But most of all, you cannot continue to build a temperament around mistaken attitudes without ultimately shortening life, increasing sickness, and alienating yourself from the better things that make life valuable. Getting away from all these false decisions and conclusions may have a tendency to cause the individual to drift a little toward religion. He may feel that his mind needs a little spiritual indoctrination. Well, that's very good as far as it goes, but there's a point here we must remember, that nearly all religions are mind-produced. They are the result of thinking. They are a result of various pages in history, various races and nations, coming to their own conclusion concerning the nature of God and what God wants. So if we are going to turn to religion for consolation, then it is very important to understand the nature of the religion that we are going to believe. And, of course, for Christians, the Sermon on the Mount is a very good foundation. But most Christians aren't able to live by it. Why? Because the mind objects to it. Now, this objection is very similar to the objection we have today, where science, for the most part, glorifies atheism, and politics can hardly wait to get rid of all theological systems. This means that that part of society which is wrong wants to take over. The reason it wants to take over is that religion is a moralism that can interfere with ambitions. It can interfere with the determination to be rich. It can interfere with the absolute competition that dominates our thinking today. The fact is that when the wrong people want a thing, that's the thing the right people don't want. The individual who needs religious consolation to protect himself from materialism has to develop his own sense of values. But once he gets a strong enough sense of values, he is not likely to give in to the hypnosis of prevailing customs and fashions. The only thing that materialism can dangle over his head as a promise is that when he's dead, he won't remember his mistakes. This is not exactly worthwhile living for, however. It's necessary to remember our mistakes even for the length of a lifetime while we're here. We only need to remember them long enough to correct them, and things start moving much better. So we go along and we find the mind sitting in all corners of this problem of living. It is present everywhere, trying to influence and dominate the lives of human beings. Yet we need it. But we need a mind that has been dedicated to a purpose. We need a mind that has accepted the responsibility of leadership over the problems of material existence. All these problems originate somewhere within the mind, and they have to be corrected by a mental dedication. We have enough evidence at this moment to convince any court of law that it is impossible to break the rules of nature and be happy. Yet we don't see nature anymore. Where we used to see nature with its roads of trees and its little dirt roads and its waterfalls, we see nothing now but condominiums, vast projects, vast metropolitan centers, great industrial complexes, and nuclear energy centers. These things are what we see. The sky and the earth and the sun and the moon are now put in small parks where we have to go to have a picnic once a while and see them. We have gradually weaned ourselves away from the true world, the world of realities, and have taken on instead a fantastic jungle which we have created. Now, the fact that we have created it does not make it good. And the fact that we have created it will not make it last. The mistakes that we make through ignorance, we must correct through intelligence. The mind, at the very beginning, became more and more immersed in such problems as survival. It tried to build a philosophy around the small things of life that the primitive human being was able to contemplate. But little by little, it has created what we call civilization, which is a compound of uncivilized peoples. It is not something that we can be proud of. And it will never get better unless we do something about it. Now, of course, long spans of history probably don't intrigue the average person too much. He's not going to die of a broken heart about something that might happen 10,000 years from now, or that a generation or a civilization will destroy itself sometime in the future. These are not the things that really lead the individual to change his ways. Even where he knows that he is passing these mistakes on to his immediate children, who may have to face the catastrophe, even this contemplation is not real enough to make any major change. Now, he thinks that a major change is getting up in front of the government and making them do something. But to make a major change for the average individual is simply his own attitude toward life. If he gets a straight view of life, he is becoming a free citizen of the universe. And the parent who can't change the political system can at the same time communicate to children the real facts of how to survive even in a catastrophe. Somewhere there has to be a hard core of realities, or every major difficulty becomes a terminal mystery, which is not reasonable or right. So we can go on, and we can go on to try and see what would happen if very quietly we begin to think it through. When we say, Joe's got a better job than I have, think it through and see whether it is as important as to make you jealous. Because if you're jealous long enough, the reward is likely to be ulcers. The man who has the job will never know you didn't like it. If you tell him so outside with very great firmness and make an enemy out of him, he will probably decide he doesn't need your friendship that much anyway. But that isn't where it ends. The hard words you use continue in you. And first thing you know, these hard words become a gastrointestinal difficulty. The final immediate payment is not karma in a future life. The immediate payment is misery here and now. And this is what most people would try to minimize as much as possible. We'll always make enough mistakes to keep ourselves busy. We won't be allowed to just sit back, as the old folk used to say, and float to paradise on flowery beds of ease. That isn't likely. But we can gradually recognize the practical side, the scientific side of our attitudes. We can realize that the effect does follow the cause, just as the wheel of the cart follows the foot of the oxen. We can realize that the stomach ache we have today could have been caused by a dozen mistakes we might have made yesterday or the day before, including gluttony, alcoholism, a hasty meal, a poor selection of dietetic materials, or just plain eating when in a case of complete nervousness or anxiety. So we have to recognize that no matter what we do that is wrong, something is going to hurt or itch somewhere. And this itch is itself a valid statement of facts. We can do what we want to about most everything except the physical body. We can change almost anything except this physical structure in which we live, and which is important to our existence in this world. We cannot fool it. We cannot deceive it. And we cannot cure it if we have sickened it beyond a certain degree. There are minor maladies that we can help. But if the cause has not been removed, they will be back. And wherever we find an individual whose mental integrities are not firm, he is a good candidate for some form of physical difficulty. Now, it doesn't follow that we can be completely happy or live forever just because we keep the rules of life. But in keeping the rules of life, it's not just the food rules that we are concerned with. the rules of life that we see shadowed in the body relationships are in all of the relationships. There is no way in which we can be unkind and gain anything but trouble. And the beautiful sense of success that we get when we have insulted another person will last for a minute, but the body chemistry will be injured maybe for months. Everything that is not pleasant, not constructive, not cooperative, and does not seek the good, everything that lacks these motives is subject to a suffering equivalent to the attitude which they have held. Some of the suffering is physical, some will be emotional, some will be mental. But where the individual has had a wrong attitude, he's going to pay for it. Now, this sounds terrible, but it doesn't really mean it that way at all. Because the equipment that we have enables us to do it right. And all of nature, the universe, and the divine powers are concerned with our doing it right. What is wanted more than anything else is the human being who is able to become a permanent factor for good in the evolution of humanity. The development of humanity is a project carried on by powers much greater than ourselves. A great wave of life is moving through space, and we are part of it. And along the edge of this wave of space are stragglers of all kinds, and there are also every type of, we'll say, vicious person, every type of troublemaker, every type of gangster somewhere in this motley group. This mass of motley group is slowing down the normal growth of human society. The more misfits we have, the more cantankerous emotional intoxicants we have, the longer this problem continues. The lesson to be learned from a small attack in the liver is applicable to the 4.5 or 5 billion human beings that populate this planet. All of them have minds. And for the most part, these minds are not doing much good for them. Instead of these minds leading them to peace and integrity, the minds are leading them to further trouble. This funny's problem is how to get away with it. What do we do? In addition to these various rules and laws, what is it that can outwit the mind? We can say maybe the spirit could, but then we don't hear many remarks coming from that level. Where and what is it that we can do to outwit the mind? Well, that which can outwit the mind, if we give it proper thought and time, that is the emotions. The emotions are far older than the mind. We had emotions long before we were able to think very much. But the emotions are a different type of thing. If emotions are hate, they will then enlist the aid of the mind to make that hate the most important thing in the world. This is what happens with wars. Wars are emotions stirred up to become mental hatreds. If, however, I'm on another angle of the matter, the heart and the emotions are in some way enriched, ennobled, or made more significant to us, the result will be a great deal more peace and charity and insight. So we can say above selfishness there can occasionally rise a great heroism. And a great heroism is an individual rising above his own security to protect something greater than himself. And this is, in almost every case, love or compassion. The individual, therefore, who is able to strengthen his emotional realizations of life, who is able to love honestly, is in a position to gain a great many benefits almost immediately. The difficulty, however, is that love plus intellect can be loaded with ulterior motives. Instead of the love being pure and true and right, the individual loves for gain, loves in some way because he hopes something better back from his affection. It's like the religionist who believes that he is building a church for the benefit of humanity, but he is also building a fame for himself. This type of thing is to be constantly watched. The mind, in the presence of an honorable and sincere affection, seldom raises much objection. But where the objections are raised is where the mind itself is still largely embedded in ulterior motives, which the individual has not corrected or matured out of in his own temperament. So when we are working for some of these causes, we turn to religion for help. We turn to religion because we believe sincerely that this can give us a new value with which to transmute the mind. Very few religions have ever been successful as mental institutions. They have always appealed to the graces of the spirit. They have appealed to the love of humanity and to the love of deity and to the recognition of the universal benevolence which governs all things, and most of all, the realization that our mistakes are due to our falling away from the practice of our religious convictions. So we can say love can do a great deal if it is sincere. Love can take a bad situation and correct it. But the correction must be honest. An individual with a stomachache and had an argument with his daughter cannot reconcile on the grounds that it will cure the stomachache. This gets back into the old problem of barter and exchange, and that's not where we are concerned. Unless the motives involved in these things are above every ulterior motive, there is very little to them. But if a person's affections are so sincere that without ulterior motive they make a great sacrifice for another, or even a small sacrifice, but do this honestly, expecting nothing in return, only under those conditions does this action have a definite therapeutic advantage. The more peaceful we become, the more gentle we are, the more we love those who are close to us, and in a large way those who need everywhere in the world, the more we get over the advantages to self and realize that we live in a world that must live and die together. If we must come to realize in the end that there can be no final good for us as persons unless we have helped to build a common good among all persons. And this is done by religion, and it could be aided by education, but only if education and all these other factors are considerably renovated. The mind must recover from the delusion of ulterior motive. There must not be that tricky little thought hiding somewhere that what we are really doing is looking for something for ourselves, even though we appear to be serving others. We must get over all ulterior motive, for the mind building on ulterior motive continues to become a schema, continues to perpetuate those very attitudes which are least likely to contribute to the public good. Now, we have more contact with other people than we realize. There are very few people who live for themselves alone. We are not just individuals in a sea of faces. We are all people. We are all involved in the same problems, and every life meets and mingles with other persons during all the years of physical existence. It is therefore very important that each person learn to understand how to mingle with people, how to work with people, and not become involved in their prejudices and their opinions and their attitudes on a variety of subjects. We have to realize that a person with a religion different from our own can be perfectly sincere, and there is no reason for us to judge that person adversely unless his conduct is open to dispute. The fact that there is no such a thing as Christian honesty or Christian dishonesty should be thought about, because all honesty is honesty. Every religion teaches it. Every human being who is honorable teaches it and lives it. And when this becomes a clean living pattern, we will have very much less crime or confusion in the world, practically none. But as long as we claim all these things as intellectual facts, but never apply them to conduct, or at least very seldom, only in a great emergency, as long as we do not live them, the mental attitude weakens, and the mind finally becomes converted to our own selfishness, and will perpetuate it and continue it on and on through all the years of our lives. We don't want to make a mental delinquent out of our own minds, and we do it every day when we conspire and we cheat and we chisel for the various advantages we are seeking desperately to maintain. We also constantly carry this forward when we try to influence other people to change their ways, primarily for our convenience. All these things are not helpful. The mind is gradually being spoiled, and a spoiled mind is a very unpleasant thing. A spoiled mind is irritable, unreasonable, vindictive, belligerent, and almost any unpleasant synonym you can think of, simply because it has been mistrained. And in society today, we are sending forth into the world generations of young people in whom vices are becoming innate. These young people have not been taught the values of life. They have been taught only how to get ahead at the cost of anything and everyone. They have not been taught any moral lesson about what happens to things. They haven't had enough in education in them to restrain from narcotics addiction. Yet they read in the paper, they see in the motion pictures, they observe everywhere the results of narcotic addiction. Yet they keep right on doing it. Why? Because in their minds, they are excusing or vindicating themselves in one of several ways. One way is that they don't care the cost, that the way they feel right now, this is the important thing. Well, the same is true in national integrations. In wars, lots of people don't believe in much of anything except what they want right now, and that usually is to survive. The narcotics addict also does this because he is against society. He wishes to prove definitely that he is no part of a society he does not respect. This can lead to all kinds of crimes which arise as a result of the terrorism of non-adjustment, incapable of straight thinking. Then the narcotic problem, again, is highly profitable. Billions of dollars a year are taken from legitimate enterprise to take care of narcotics addiction. Now, these people know this. There's no person probably lower than the third or fourth grade who hasn't been some way contacted. The school yards are now practically centers for the distribution of narcotics. Why? How is it that young people with minds that are supposed to be growing up to become useful citizens being snared in a thing like this? Well, the reason it is that the mind tolerates it. The mind gets all kinds of attitude developments which make it accept this. The mind thinks it's wonderful to be clever, to be different, to take chances, and most of all, to lose all sense of responsibility. Don't worry. Do what you want to now. All this type of attitude ends in a tragedy. And in this case, the body itself goes with the rest. And most of these younger people will ultimately either find a remedy or else will kill themselves. So why does the mind do this to us? Why doesn't the mind see the Sermon on the Mount? Why doesn't the mind accept the Ten Commandments? Well, the reason why, largely, is the ulterior motive that is in ourselves. There is no evil spirit somewhere teaching us to be evil. The thing is that down in our hearts and hearts of hearts, a great many people simply want what they want. And the way of getting it is immaterial. The main way is to have it. They feel certain that if they get what they want, they will have leisure, happiness, peace, tranquility, success, superiority, distinction, and power. When what they really get is the same 6 square feet that they always got. Back to the earth from which they came. There is no way of winning that kind of a fight. But why fight? The emotions don't say so usually, unless they're badly corrupted. The body is screaming, don't do it. But the mind has found out how to argue these things until the individual surrenders. The mind finally permits him to do what he secretly wanted to do for the secret reasons that he wanted to do it. Almost every one of these young people has some kind of a discouragement against the facts of life that is leading them to this type of attitude. And yet they are doing nothing to correct the unhappy facts of life that are driving people to crime, narcotics, and alcoholism. They are people who cannot adjust to the corruptions of the time unless they first demoralize themselves. So this goes on continuously and has been for a long time. The mind has to be taken over. And when an individual makes a commitment to religion or to anything which he feels is necessary to his well-being, he's got to make a complete conviction of it. He's got to go to work on his own mind. He's got to use that side of his mind, which is his true mind, the divine mind in himself, and get away from this animal mind that is constantly contributing to his delinquency. The first thing the individual must do in censoring a thought is to decide whether that thought is right or wrong, basically. If it is wrong, reject it. If it is right, fight for it, even though it may take a great deal of energy, time, and sacrifice. But the fact remains, and has always been, as far as our civilization is concerned, the two minds are fighting each other. One mind is a mind of gratification. The other is a mind of edification. One says do what you please, the other says do what you should. And the world is divided now between these two approaches to the problems of existence. Unless we solve this as individuals, we will not be able to continue the way of life we want to become accustomed to. If we do not do something about these things, we will be mentally, emotionally, or physically sick. And while many are not in a condition in which they are being treated for their problems, it's safe to say that a large percentage of the world's population at the present time is neurotic, far more than those that are under treatment. So the mind, the highest aspect of our mind, what the Hindu calls the Alrupa Manas, the divine mind, the mind of truth in ourselves, is forever fighting the mind of gratification. It is a struggle between spirit and body. It is between soul and the soulless. It is between the invisible cause and the visible compromised effect. So we each of us have this little fight on our hands. In many cases, it's not a very serious one. There are not great big things that we're doing wrong. But there should be a few, at least moderate-sized things, that we're doing right. And doing right completely, because we believe in them, because we know they're right, and because we know that we must face the consequences if we don't. Philosophy, however, is not based upon a perpetuation of punishment. It is actually a system of cultivation by which the individual recovers from the need of punishment by gradually overcoming his own mistakes. By doing it this way, the mind becomes the most powerful instrument for good that is imaginable. But until that time, it's going to be hovering around trying to convince us that we should compromise principles in order to have a little more fun now and dyspepsia later. This type of thinking has got to come more and more clearly into our consciousness. Well, folks, I think that's all for the morning.